ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Bhaktivedanta Swami Tinamine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharini Navishya Sunyavadi Paschitya Deshatarini Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gauravakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Panchakalpits, Rubias, Chakripas, and Dubhivisha, Patitanam, Padanubhya, Vaishnubhya, Namo Namaha. So, there's text 12 that I'll read, and we'll chant together text 13, which I believe should be on the board. Text 13 and 14 are together, because 13 and 14 have a purport. So I'll just read text 12 and then we can move to text 13 and 14. Anjan Bia Yan Nan Mar Da Sri Avalekhana Amisam Madha Shraganda Lepalan Kantams Tyaye Yurye Brihat Rataha. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Brahmacharis or grihasthas who have taken the vow of celibacy as described above should not indulge in the following: applying powder or ointment to the eyes, massaging the head with oil, massaging the body with the hands, seeing a woman or painting a woman's picture, eating meat, drinking wine, decorating the body with flower garlands, smearing scented ointment on the body, or decorating the body with ornaments. These they should give up. And now we have text 13, which we'll chant responsibly. Ushitvaivam Guru Kule Dijo Dijava Buddhiyacha Trayim Sango Panishadam Yavatartam Yatabalam Ushitvaivam Guru Kule Dijo Ditya va buddhya cha Trayim sango panishadam Yavatartam yatabalam Ushitvat vaivam guru kule Tvijo ditya va buddhya cha Trayim sango panishadam Yavatartam yatabalam. Please chant. Ushit Vaivam Guru Kule Dijo Ditya Mabutya Cha Trayin Sango Panishadam Yavad Artam Yatabalam Ushit Vaivam Guru Kule Dijo Ditya Vabudya Cha Trayin Sango Panishadam Yavad Artam Yatabalam Ushit Vaivam Guru Kule Dijo Ditya Vabudya Cha Jain Sango Panishadam Yavad Artam Yatabalam Ushit Vaivam Guru Kule Dijo Ditya Vabudya Cha Trayim Sango Panishadam Yavad Artam Yatabalam. There's also text 14, so I'll read that. Tatvavaram Anujnato Guru Kamam Yadishvaraha Kriham Vanam Vapravishet Pravayet Satra Vavashet. So the word for word. Ushitva, residing, evam, in this way, Gurukule, under the care of the spiritual master. Dvija, the twice born, namely the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas. Aditya, studying Vedic literature. Avabhujya, understanding it properly. Cha, and Trayim, the Vedic literature. Saanga, along with supplementary parts. Upanishadam, as well as the Upanishads. Yavat Artam, as far as possible. Yata Baham, as far as one can according to one's ability. Daitva, giving. Varam, remuneration. Anunyataha, being asked. Guru, of the spiritual master. Kaman, desires. Yadi, if. Ishvaraha, capable. Griham, household life. Vanam, retired life. Va, either. Pravishet, one should enter. Pravrajet, or get out of. Tatra, there. Va, either. Vaset, should reside. A translation by Srila Prabhupada. According to the rules and regulations mentioned above, one who is twice born, namely a Brahmana, Kshatriya or Vaishya, should reside in the Gurukul under the care of the spiritual master. There he should study and learn all the Vedic literatures along with their supplements and the Upanishads according to his ability and power to study. If possible, the student or disciple should reward the spiritual master with the remuneration the spiritual master requests. And then, following the master's order, the disciple should leave and accept one of the other ashrams, namely the Grihastha ashram, Vanaprastha ashram, or Sannyas ashram, as he desires. To study the Vedas and understand them, of course, requires some special intelligence. But the members of the three higher sections of society, namely the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, must learn the Vedic literatures according to their capability and power to understand. In other words, studying the Vedic literature is compulsory for everyone but the Sudras and the Antyayas. The Vedic literature gives the knowledge that can lead one to understand the absolute truth, Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. Gurukul, or the reformatory educational institution, should be used only to understand Vedic knowledge. At the present time, there are many educational institutions for training and technology, but such knowledge has nothing to do with understanding of the absolute truth. Technology, therefore, is meant for the Shudras, whereas the Vedas are meant for the Dvijas. Consequently, this verse states, Dvija Ditya Va Bhujya Cha Traim Sangopanishadam. At the present time, in the age of Kali, practically everyone is a Sudra, and no one is a Dvija. Therefore, the condition of society has very much deteriorated. Another point to be observed from this verse is that from the Brahmachari ashram, one may accept the Sannyas ashram, Vanaprastha ashram, or Grihastha ashram. It is not compulsory for a Brahmachari to become a Grihastha, because the ultimate aim is to understand the absolute truth. There is no necessity of going through all the different ashrams. Thus, one may proceed to the Sannyas ashram directly from the Brahmachari ashram. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur accepted the Sannyas ashram directly from the Brahmachari ashram. In other words, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur did not think it compulsory to accept the Grihastha ashram or Vanaprastha ashram. So, I decided to focus on 13 and 14 because there's the purport, and also just in passing to mention that text 12 is very much interconnected with yesterday's verse, which dealt with the vow of celibacy and the implications of it. And so particularly text 12 is drawing our attention to some of those aspects that could jeopardize that vow of celibacy. So there's a whole listing of various ways in which attention is either drawn to the body or one's own attention is going to the maintenance of the body in a more extreme way. So I'll move to text 13 and 14. So particularly these two texts are emphasizing the study of the Vedas and understanding them. And Srila Prabhupada makes a very nice point. He says that it requires special intelligence to be able to study the Vedas and understand them. So even notwithstanding that special intelligence that's required, there's an obligation on the part of the higher sections of society. And notice he's drawing those higher sections of society, just the three categories, the fourth one's excluded. So the Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas, and the Vaishyas. And there's a very nice point made. You know, it's generally in education one takes this into account. One has to take into account the particular capacity of the persons in either of those three categories to study and the particular person's power to understand. So this is just a natural thing in education. One understands there's individual differences, and there's also differences according to the particular category in which one is falling, be it a Brahmana, Kshatriya, or Vaishya. And this is despite the fact that in each of those three categories, according to this verse, the persons are twice born. Means they've actually taken initiation into this chanting of this holy name, and they've taken Brahmanical initiation. Still, there's differences. I thought to turn to how this particular point of understanding comes into play. Because one knows, okay, everybody may have a different capacity to understand. And Lord Krishna actually kindly explains how this capacity is different. And very nicely, you know, everything again gets divided into three categories. Even the capacity to understand gets divided into three categories. So this is how Krishna puts it. There's an understanding by which one knows what ought to be done and what ought not to be done, what is to be feared and what is not to be feared, what is binding and what is liberating. So this kind of understanding is in the mode of goodness. So this is the understanding that's of particular importance. And you find this in Bhagavad Gita 18:10, where Krishna categorizes those three types of understanding. So that's the first kind of understanding. And I think particularly persons who have take advijas are clearly meant to be having a more mode of goodness way of understanding. They can make those proper distinctions, you know, what needs to be done, what shouldn't be done, what you can fear, what you shouldn't fear, what will bind you to the material world, what will liberate you. But again, there is the fact that there are personalities with different modes of material nature. So then you get to Kshatriyas, which are characterized as actually being more in the mode of passion. So here's an understanding that Krishna, the second category of the type of understanding that exists. He says an understanding, this is the second type, an understanding which cannot distinguish between what's religious and irreligious, between action that should be done and action that shouldn't be done. That kind of understanding is in the mode of passion. So you can see the capacity is a little bit less. and maybe there's also a little bit less depth, because the first category of understanding in the mode of goodness, there's mention of one knows what to fear and what not to fear. You notice in the second category, in the mode of passion, no mention of that. The Kshatriya generally fearless. It's one of the characteristics. But there's the problem. May not always be able to distinguish between what's religious and irreligious, or what action should be done or shouldn't be done. And then since Srila Prabhupada states that the study of the Vedas is actually compulsory for everybody, except the sudras or the shudras and the avyayas, we can understand that the particular understanding that's been referred to here for the Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas, and the Vaishyas is that understanding which falls into these two categories, or maybe a little bit mode of passion. There has to be that understanding, because the third category of understanding doesn't actually fall into this realm of those who are the twice-born Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, because the third category of understanding that Krishna describes is actually particularly in the mode of ignorance. I'll read what that one is. So this doesn't apply to the twice-born, but this is understanding in the mode of ignorance. An understanding which considers irreligion to be irreligion, to be religion, and religion to be irreligion, under the spell of illusion and darkness, and strives always in the wrong direction, O Prita, is in the mode of ignorance. So this can't possibly apply to the three categories that we're talking about, because generally that mode of ignorance is something that, as we go further into trying to look at this particular verse, we'll see that it's something that immediately gets dissipated if one is studying the Vedas. So the Shudras are not studying the Vedas. So hence there's not that understanding of what's religion or what's not religion. There's confusion on that point, generally, because if you don't have knowledge, you can't understand that basic thing. What is of interest to us is that understanding this in the mode of goodness and that special intelligence that Srila Prabhupada is referring to, so that we want to look at how one can actually distinguish between religion and irreligion. So Srila Jiva Goswami, and I've gone to him because he gives some insight into why it is that the Vedas are that source of knowledge. So this is the very nice, I think tremendous, very logical way he thinks it through. So I'm going to go through how Srila Jiva Goswami thinks this through to give emphasis to why the Vedas are the source of knowledge. So this is Srila Jiva Goswami's very nice logical point by point reasoning process. So he tells us that an understanding that, or getting a knowledge that comes exclusively from sensory perception is inadequate for acquiring spiritual knowledge. So you can't just look, or you can't just hear, or you can't just smell. It's not actually adequate for getting spiritual knowledge. So, and this point is supported by just simple observation. If you look at animals, outside, if one sits a little bit, of course it's a bit cold now, but you may observe birds or squirrels, and or even passing people walking with dogs on their leashes. And one thing you'll notice is that all those creatures, they've got senses just like human beings do. So they're able to look, they're able to smell, they're able to hear, they're able to touch things. Now, the way that they actually use their senses is they accept something or they reject something merely based on their senses. So a bird will peck at the ground, and by that, touching, it can distinguish, oh, this is a worm or this is a branch. But it's not processing that way, it just knows, it's using the senses to accept or reject. Oh, soft, oh yes, worm. Hard, a twig. So, but these creatures don't get any spiritual knowledge based on all those activities they're doing on a daily basis, accepting this, rejecting that, twig, worm, tree trunk, grass. Doesn't lead to any kind of spiritual knowledge. So Now, Srila Jiva Goswami, he contrasts the animal's way of acquiring knowledge with that of young children. So, in the case of young children, they get their knowledge simply by hearing reliable words from their parents. That's how they're getting their knowledge. So they're not having to, you know, go and touch a tree trunk to check what that is, or touch the grass, check what that is. The parent can actually say, that's a tree trunk over there and that's grass. So we're going to walk on the pavement. The child has got knowledge already, just not even having to go and touch it or smell it or taste it or anything. Doesn't have to use the senses. Just has got heard the words from the parents. Oh, all right, this pavement, this is where I walk. That there is grass and that's a tree. So, so this is the young child's way of getting knowledge. So he goes on to say that you could conclude that verbal testimony is the only certain means for acquiring knowledge. So why it's certain is the parents have already had an understanding of, you know, a tree form, that, you know, a tree grows so high it has branches. Grass, you know, can grow to maybe 8 inches, is generally trimmed. This hard part here is man-made concrete. They've already processed all that. They've understood all of that. So they can actually communicate that quite easily. So that's why it's a very reliable way of acquiring knowledge. And it's called shabda, or verbal testimony. Somebody testifies, this is what this is. I've understood this this way. So now, Srila Jiva Goswami carries on with his logical reasoning, and he says that you can't define shabda, or this verbal testimony, just as language that's free from delusion. You can't say that. There could be delusion in the language that one is hearing. And the reason for that is that every single entity thinks that his own opinion is quite correct. No delusion here. This, what I think, what I understand, definitely correct. So, especially if there's not some means to verify it, that opinion. So, therefore, you can't ascertain the value of differing opinions just if you think that language is free from delusion. So you can't say that shabda or verbal testimony is free from delusion, that that defines shabda. It can't be the definition for shabda, because there's still that problem. There may be differing opinions. So you also can't say that shabda or verbal testimony is language that's free from delusion, because it would also make verbal testimony dependent on something else. So another means of knowing. You know, there's got to be something behind it. So if you just say, oh, the language, the verbal testimony is free from delusion, that still wouldn't be adequate as a means of knowledge, because behind it could be another way, something else that's allowing one to know, and then comes the verbal testimony. So therefore, you could say that shabda isn't the ultimate authority. So this is Srila Jiva Goswami's argument. Then Srila Jiva Goswami helps us out. He gives the definition of what shabda or verbal testimony actually is, which makes it, you know, the way that you can actually get knowledge or understanding, or at least acquire valid knowledge. So this is his definition. Shabda is that which everyone studies to become learned. So it's got to be something that everybody, the brahmanas, the kshatriyas, the vaishyas, anybody can study, and they're going to become learned. So that's what the kind of shabda it has to be. And not only will they become learned, they're going to become learned in every subject. So it's got to be such great verbal testimony that you'll actually understand every subject from studying that kind of verbal testimony. So it's got to be very, concentrated. So, and carrying on his definition, it's got to impart the ultimate wisdom. So it's got to be the ultimate wisdom. Like, no, nothing else is more wise than what you're studying there. It's got to be the ultimate wisdom. And it's got to have the ability, this is the other interesting thing, it's got to be able to purify your sensory perception. So your sensory perception, where we heard just a while back, you know, you have some experience, you have some understanding, but it may not be perfect because somebody could come along and say, well, you know, you also get a tree that's 6 inches high. Oh, I never thought about that. I had it in my mind that the tree has to be, you know, at least 10 feet high. So so it's got to purify that you've perceived by your senses. Means, you know, you've got to get a much deeper understanding. So so that it would also, you know, you would have immediately an understanding that within those at tree trunk, there's also like some kind of fluids that are traveling. Those fluids are giving nourishment. You know, all of that would have to come. That would be the purifying of the senses. Because by looking, you couldn't see that. But if you actually reading Shabda or the ultimate wisdom, just by reading it, you would understand everything. Oh, that trunk also within there are these up and down tubes that are taking nourishment, throwing out waste, but you can't see it. So now it's the Shabda, this Shabda that Srila Jiva Goswami, the further definition of the verbal testimony that's so important, he says it's got to be self-manifest since time immemorial. Means there wasn't a beginning, there wasn't a middle, there wasn't an end. Because, you know, all kinds of things can happen. If you say, oh, this began at that time. Oh, well, wasn't there something before that? So it means it's manifest since time immemorial. And in fact, it's the total body of authoritative statements. So nothing else exists. All the thinking, all the understanding is so concentrated, doesn't have a time when it began, doesn't have a time when it ends, and it's everything that's authoritative. So all of that will actually make up verbal testimony that's going to give knowledge. This is Srila Jiva Goswami, because you have to look at it. You have to understand why it is that one has to study the Vedas. So, and it's also the basis of traditional knowledge. So not only does it have all the authoritative statement, but it's the basis for any other kind of knowledge, other branches of knowledge. So amazing. So now we're going to take this definition of Srila Jiva Goswami's, where he's very nicely explained this Shabda or verbal testimony, and we're going to connect it to what Srila Prabhupada has said in this purport. And his statement is that the higher classes of society need to study the Vedas. So this Shabda that Srila Jiva Goswami is referring to is none other than the revealed scriptures known as the Vedas. So his definition ties in very nicely for why it's necessary to study the Vedas. I mean, you can see the definition is all-encompassing. So, and here are some of the words that Srila Jiva Goswami uses to describe the Vedas. And I'm really emphasizing this point because this verse is really pointing to this necessity. So the words he uses are, for the Vedas, they are eternally manifest verbal expressions that have no human author and that appear with no beginning in time from the cause of all, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it appears again and again from him at the beginning of each cycle of creation. So, coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that's why they are eternally manifest. They have no human author. And they appear with no beginning in time, because Krishna is the cause of all causes. So he's the cause of the Vedas. So again, even with each cycle of creation, at the beginning of the new cycle, again the Vedas appear. So continuous. So you can read this in Tattva Sandarbha, particularly in text 10, these particular words of Srila Jiva Goswami. So he goes on to say that the Vedas, we can make an assumption based on this, the definition that we've just gone through, the understanding that they're coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We can presume them to be free from faults. And faults such as being that there's delusion of any kind, just because of where the source of those Vedas is. So therefore, they have to be accepted as authoritative. And particularly by persons who want to take instructions from Krishna. You would have to, that's a fundamental thing. If you're actually going to study the Vedas, there has to be an acceptance that these are authoritative. You can't actually otherwise bring yourself to study something if you don't think it's authoritative. So, now, this is a prerequisite for this power to think that is referred to in this verse. And you could even say the prerequisite for learning or even being able to make judgments. It rests on this acceptance. It's absolutely essential. It's like anything. If you don't accept it, you're going to be blocked off from it. You're not going to be able to actually take advantage of it. So, and if one actually accepts the Vedas as an infallible means for perfect knowledge, even that acceptance, it's supposed to be that it's coming by the mercy of Krishna. So even being able to accept it is coming from Krishna. He's permitting that. So one thing is, well, of course, you know, I accept all. But it's not like that. It's not like that. He's allowing for it to be understood. And you can have personal experience of this. You can read a particular verse. You can read the purport. And suddenly something will jump out. The reason for that is Krishna's allowing for that. Yeah. So you could say that the power to think and to learn and to make judgments by any of the spiritual orders that are listed here, or the three, is by the excessive kindness of Lord Krishna. So it's a very special thing that one is somehow being allowed to have an acceptance of the Vedas. So, and now, what to speak of the particular persons who've gone and tried to seek out a spiritual master? They've actually come into an ashram situation. It means that they actually truly are getting excessive kindness from Lord Krishna. I mean, I often often used to wonder, like in when I first came to the Brooklyn Temple, I often used to wonder, how did I find myself here? Because it didn't fit any picture that I was carrying around. I had some thought that, you know, there had to be something more to life. But I always wondered about that. And now, you know, just going through this particular verse, it's making me understand there was a special kindness on the part of Lord Krishna that allowed for me to come into that situation. And the same applies to all of us. It's a special, special kindness. So now, because of this particular point, I thought, because Srila Narada is speaking these words, I thought to look at what was his experience, how he actually describes how he came to understand the instructions of Lord Krishna. I think it's very relevant since he's speaking here. So this is how he says was his experience. As they were leaving, those Bhakti Vedantas, who are very kind to pure-hearted souls, instructed me in that most confidential subject, which is instructed by the personality of Godhead himself. It's a very simple statement. he saw himself as a pure-hearted soul, I'm inferring from this. Means, you know, he was willing to accept. And he also saw the persons who were instructing has been very kind. So those are the two reciprocal, would one say, moods that need to be there. The kindness of those that are instructing, and also a certain pure-heartedness on the part of the person who's come to seek out those great personalities, or a pure-heartedness in terms of a willingness to accept those personalities and that they also are teaching Krishna's message. Anyway, I'll give a personal anecdote. It's very soon after coming to the Brooklyn Temple, I was told there's a home program that was being run in downtown Manhattan. I was living in Manhattan. The first person I heard speaking was somebody in the sannyas order, His Holiness Dhanadhar Swami. And I sat there completely amazed that somebody could actually speak something of what I'd read, because I'd read a little bit of Krishna conscious philosophy. I couldn't understand how it was possible that somebody could express the ideas exactly how I'd read it. Because generally, you know, one's memory is not so good, and one may put it in one's own words, but I was hearing the ideas expressed exactly how they were described, like in Bhagavad Gita, and I'd been reading Lord Kapila Dev's teachings. So, so it's these kind of instructions that are referred to here by Narada. Those that give knowledge and that can lead one to understand the absolute truth. So this is actually the purpose of this kind of institution or the Gurukul environment. It's a reformatory educational institution. And it means not only is one learning to judge and think through the eyes of the Vedas, through the eyes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who's the source of them, but one's also beginning to change behaviors and reconfigure one's whole framework, internal framework. So now, this is what starts happening then. And again, I'm going to look at what Srila Narada describes as happening. Because he tries to break down what he's learned from the association of the Vedantas. during the 4 months of the rainy season, as he put it. And this is his description of what started happening. As soon as I got a taste of the personality of Godhead, my attention to hear of the Lord was unflinching. And as my taste developed, I could realize that it was only in my ignorance that I had accepted gross and subtle coverings, for both the Lord and I are transcendental. So this is from the first canto in the fifth chapter in the 27th verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is how Narada Muni describes what starts happening. One gets this unflinching desire to hear. So one of the senses becomes very prominent. One wants to use that sense. One wants to actually have those words, that shabda or that verbal testimony. One wants it to be entering the ear. So that's the extraordinary thing, the first thing that starts happening. And then a taste starts to develop. And the reason for the taste developing, and this is the extraordinary thing, one starts to get some understanding of the gross and subtle body as being separate from the soul. So this is so profound and so revelatory that one actually, continues with having that taste to want to know more and more and more. So Narada's description of his reformation, is actually that something changed for him. And the thing that changed for him was that one major error got removed. That major error, and this is the significant thing, is that in ignorance, one makes this mistake that one thinks that one's self and God are products of material nature. We must be the same. You know, here I am with this body, God must have a body, must be like mine. So products of material nature. So this is the biggest error that starts getting corrected. Because both Lord Krishna and oneself are transcendental. So this is the major reformation that happens, the major change. One's whole behavior starts changing because that conceptual framework now takes into account this factor. There's the existence of something beyond the gross and subtle self that one was thinking about earlier. And this becomes possible because through that shabda or that verbal testimony, you're getting direct association with Krishna. It's transcendental association. So that's where one's beginning to understand, oh, I have a connection in that kind of way. So now, I'll bring up this particular metaphor that's used because it describes a lot of this whole reformatory process as it is, how it actually happens. This is the dynamic of it. So the dynamic is Krishna is compared to sun, so a lot of light, and ignorance is in material existence is compared to darkness. So you can't see very much, you can't see anything, shapes, forms, nothing. And when ignorance is removed, one realizes that nothing is existing without that light that's Krishna. I shouldn't say it, put it that way, but the light is allowing for that darkness to move out of the way, and one realizes that the reason for anything existing is because there's the source of that existence. And so the gross and subtle body is seen as emanating actually from Krishna. So this is the profound reformation that happens. I mean, it's very profound. I mean, simply stated, but it's extremely profound. So the special intelligence that Srila Prabhupada is referring to here, Prahlad Maharaj, I'm going to use something that he says, also because it's in reference to Narada. So this is Prahlad Maharaj talking. He says, Narayan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the well-wisher and friend of all living entities, formally explained this transcendental knowledge to the great saint Narada. Such knowledge is extremely difficult to understand without the mercy of a saintly person like Narada. But everyone who has taken shelter of Narada's disciplic succession can understand this confidential knowledge. So that's the beauty. That's why all those personalities that become twice born, as this verse is stating, be they brahmanas, kshatriyas, or vaishyas, they all are actually able to understand this confidential knowledge because of the kindness of a saintly personality. So it's dependent on that kindness. And and in this particular verse, it's just mentioned that after this whole reformation, this whole new conceptual framework that now one has, one is then can choose to leave the physical place where the reformatory training went on. You can choose to leave it, but that's dependent on the spiritual master because he may direct one to take up duties that may be in like a grahastha setting, or it may be duties that even require somebody to travel like a sannyasi. And this is dependent on him. So, and he'll make that decision based on the modes of nature of the particular entities that are involved and the work that would be most suitable for those particular entities. So that was how much I understood from this particular verse. If anybody wants to share something or has some particular thought or even some question that can help us expand it.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. I had a question earlier, but I think you answered it, but I'll still ask it and maybe you could elaborate on it. At the beginning, I need some water. This is kind of loud, isn't it? At the beginning of your class, you were mentioning things to be feared and things not to be feared. Things to be feared and things not to be feared. And one thing that reminded me of, I mentioned it the other day, in chapter 9 of Bhaktivinoda Thakura's Jiva Dharma, he mentions, he says there's six, he quotes the Hari Bhakti Vilas, I guess it's some scripture written by one devotee, maybe the Goswamis, but he says there's six causes of fall down. I don't remember all of them, but it was in a category of Vaishnava Parad, to criticize a Vaishnava, to strike him, I think to kill him, to not welcome him upon sight. I would think killing him would be Aparad, but and also one thing he mentioned was not to feel happy in the presence of Vaishnava. And I thought that was funny. But one thing I noticed that wasn't on the list, which I was kind of shocked, it didn't mention like lusting after Vaishnava. That wasn't in the category. And one thing I meditate, maybe it wasn't in the categories because I guess one has already fallen already, or one is really happy to be in presence of Vaishnavas. But my question basically is related to the point of, and it's regarding the Adi Lila of Chaitanya Charitamrita in chapter 8. It basically talks about offenses against the holy names. And it basically mentions that if tears not coming to one's eyes when one chants the holy name, it means one is probably committing offenses. So my question is that you kind of answered it, but maybe I'll ask you afterwards to elaborate on it. How does one know whether one is committing offenses against the holy name? And whether one is, whether Krishna is forcing one to be patient, because we hear in the Netta of Instruction that patience is also necessary for the development of bhakti. So how does one know that if I'm not getting that higher taste, am I committing offenses, or is just Krishna just, you know, wants me to be patient? That's why he's not giving me that higher taste, you know, so it won't be so easily, boom. So can you explain that?
Okay. So the question has to do with putting it in a concise way. Why is one not getting a higher taste sometimes? And Jai Baladev particularly looked at chanting and asked the question, was there some kind of offense that was happening there, or was it actually Krishna not allowing for the higher taste to develop? So, one of the points that was mentioned through this discussion of persons that, or different sections of society that are taking to study of the Vedas, and they're twice born, which implies that there is chanting that's going on, is that there's a certain understanding that there's always, and this is a generalization, that there's always kindness on the part of Krishna, and there's always kindness on the part of saintly persons. So the first thought that a difficulty or an obstacle in chanting may be Krishna withholding kindness could be dismissed, because we can take it as a given based on the authoritative statements of Narada, Prahlad Maharaj. There's great kindness that's always shown by Krishna and saintly personalities. So therefore, one, if one is finding oneself in a situation where there's some sort of block or some sort of lack of taste happening, then one has to take it that the lack of taste has to do with some unacceptance on our part of what we are learning. So with chanting, what one is learning is that there's no difference between Krishna and his name. So he's fully present in his name. And you had mentioned, Jai Baladev, that actually there's Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur writing that, well, you mentioned it in that context, I don't know if it was exactly Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but that there should be tears coming from one's eyes because there's such full awareness that saying the holy name is none different from Krishna being present. So just uttering the name is as good as summoning Krishna. He's there. So one's not experiencing that kind of understanding. So one has to take it that this is natural. Natural because there's a progressive cleansing, a progressive clearing of the ignorance. It's progressive. So one takes it that that should be happening further along the way when the ignorance has got dissipated. But at the present time, you know, there's some ignorance there, and that's what's preventing that, you know, full awareness. So one has to grow in awareness. It's gradual, slowly. You know, that cloud of ignorance is getting moved aside. And again, one has to have that understanding there is kindness. Just by one's endeavoring, some kindness will be shown. So one just keeps endeavoring, but believing there's kindness. And your first part that you spoke about where you were talking about Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur having a whole list of offenses that could be done towards Vaishnavas. And you had the question, you were wondering, why wasn't one of the offenses that there could be lust for another Vaishnavi?
I was thinking about Bilbo Mangal Thakur or the prostitute or Jagai Madai, so many examples. So maybe that's why it wasn't on the list also, because if you get the mercy of a Vaishnava, then you could commit unlimited sins, but if you get that mercy, then... So that's what I always meditate on that in that perspective, so...
You were thinking about the various things that can be offenses to saintly persons, and you were listing that some of those offenses could be not being happy in the presence of a saintly person, or criticizing a saintly person, and the question of why would it not be listed as an offense is of if one had some lustful mood towards a Vaishnavi. At least that's what I understood. Well, that's sort of a different category from the offenses that are listed in relation to one's dealings or view of Vaishnavas in general. Generally, when one sees another Vaishnava, there's happiness, joyfulness. It's very wonderful. It doesn't matter when, where, how, always there's joyfulness meeting another Vaishnava. So that's why those offenses means that the heart is closed in some way. It's an offense, certainly an offense. One's not seeing the saintly person properly. One's looking at the gross and subtle coverings and not seeing the soul. And then in terms of, having lustful feelings, well, that's something that, you can't call an offense. It's not an offense, rather it's something that has to be examined in terms of the vow of celibacy. So one has to consider bringing that question to a saintly person and expressing that particular struggle. And then with expression of that struggle, one can actually receive some guidance. Perhaps it is that, one's ashram needs to change. Or perhaps it is that one is not attending to one's duties properly or with the correct consciousness. Something is, one's looking elsewhere for some happiness or some satisfaction. So that would have to be determined by a particular saintly person that one knows well and could actually advise one how to proceed or how to manage that. But it's not an offense, it's more a struggle.
Thank you. That was more of a joke too when I brought that point up. I guess it didn't go over so well. But one thing I appreciate, you answered my first question in one of your class. The first question you answered that I wanted to appreciate a point that you made. You were making basically that even if tears are not coming to our eyes, okay, that's fine. But you made the point earlier in the class, a point that I was just meditating on like a day or two ago from the Bhagavad Gita. You mentioned that when something to the extent that when one has a higher taste or when Krishna blesses one with that, one wants to hear more and more and more and more and more, right? That was your point, right? So if anyone wants to reference this point, I was just reading this the other day in regards to your point. This is mentioned in chapter 10, verse 18 of the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna says, I'm never satisfied of hearing your glories, so I just want to hear more and more and more. And then Prabhupada, in the purport, he quotes another verse from the Bhagavatam expressing that point, same point. And for me, that was encouraging, a point I appreciated, because even if tears or we're not crying or the symptoms not coming still, but if we still, you know, Krishna blesses us that I'm at least enthusiastic, you know, tears may not be coming to my eyes, but at least, you know, I'm in more enthusiastic. It's not like, oh, this class is boring, reading Prabhupada's books are boring, everything's boring, just ungrateful. So that was one point I appreciated, okay, that you answered my question. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing that.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your kind attention to Prabhupada Ki Jai.